The smoke-related costs to our health from our most recent bushfire season could be, and be ready for this, could be close to $2 billion. That's the estimate from Australian researchers based at several major Australian universities. They've also compared that cost to health from smoke with the previous 19 other fire seasons, and they found that the 2019-2020 season was more than nine times the average annual bushfire-associated health cost for the previous decade. And we're asking you today, has the air pollution from that last season had any long-term impact on your health? You can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Just search for RN Life Matters. This startling research comparing health costs from fire seasons has been peer-reviewed and published in the journal Nature Sustainability. With me is Professor Bin Jalaluddin, who is a chief investigator in the Centre for Air Pollution, Energy and Health Research. He's also an environmental epidemiologist and was part of the research team. And Bin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Can you break down for us that health cost figure of almost $2 billion? What are the components that lead to that kind of summation there?
Sure. Look, we only looked at four major health costs. We looked at ED or emergency department visits for asthma, hospitalizations for heart disease, hospitalizations for lung disease, and deaths. So we only looked at a small number of outcomes, and and the cost for that for the most recent bushfires was nearly $2 billion.
And if you break those down, for example, smoke-related premature deaths, Bin, kind of figures did you have for that?
I think the majority of the cost would be for the deaths, although there were much fewer deaths compared to hospitalizations and ED visits.
Right.
The sort of majority, about 80% or so of the deaths, of the cost would be due to the deaths.
Well, I've got some of these other figures here in front of me as well. More than 3,000 hospital admissions for heart and breathing disorders, and more than 1,500 emergency department visits for asthma. So if you compare the almost $2 billion you've come up with as an estimate for last bushfire season, what's its nearest neighbour in terms of costs from the other 19 bushfire seasons you investigated?
Right. Sure. I think it was the 2002-2003 fire season was about $300 million. And then for the other fire seasons, obviously, they were less than that.
So, I mean, that's a really serious and dramatic increase in health costs to our community based on that last season. Should we dismiss it as a one-off?
Bushfires are fairly unpredictable. Some fire seasons we don't have much of a problem with bushfires, and other seasons we do. The 2019-2020 bushfire season was fairly exceptional. As you would know, and most of your listeners would know, they were fairly extensive, they were widespread, they were very intense, and affected large numbers of people in all the major cities. Now, whether we will have bushfires of such magnitude and extent again in the near future, it is difficult to know. But what we do know is that with climate change, increasing heat waves and drought, and more longer periods of drought, that there is the probability of more frequent and extensive bushfires is there.
Yeah. So essentially, what you're talking about here is plan for the worst, but hope for the best. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
But yeah.
What we do know is that the bushfire season will last longer. We will have more frequent bushfires and more intensive bushfires. But what is difficult to know is when exactly the severe seasons might happen.
Yes, Yes. Some of the things that struck me about the data you've collected so far on this, the estimate of nearly $2 billion cost for health, our health, from that last season. You mentioned that most of the data you've collected is based around those four events, which are often quite physical manifestations of health damage to individuals. Whereas, of course, you could add on to that, I imagine, mental health cost as well.
Oh, absolutely. What we have reported is just the, one could say, the tip of the iceberg. There are obviously many other costs involved. There is the cost of mental health. There's cost of lost productivity. There's cost to our first responders, the firefighters, the various small communities up and down the coast that were severely affected. And from the more short-term acute mental health effects to much longer-term effects on people's health, we haven't valued all those costs. There are also costs to our fauna, our wildlife, flora, ecosystems were destroyed. So there's a whole range of other costs that we didn't take into account. Certainly, the $2 billion, although it is extraordinarily high, is just for aspects.
Yes, and as you say, that could be a tip of a much larger iceberg. The monitoring that was happening at this time and the data you collected from those monitoring stations, were they all metropolitan-based or were they also spread across rural and regional?
Okay, they were mainly all based in the cities, mainly metropolitan. There would be a few that would be in the major regional centers and regional towns, but we do not have that many air quality monitors in rural and regional areas. So they would be mainly in the large cities.
And a final question on this part of the data. I'm just thinking too, do you have a base level of air pollution that you notice across all monitoring stations? And then what goes above that is what you're collecting? Or is there another way of dealing with this data?
No, I guess very simply, what we did was we looked at the data from all the monitoring stations across the country, and there would be just over 180 of them.
Yeah.
And we took the long-term average as our baseline. And on days that were exceptionally high, or what we might say over the 95th centile, so in the top 5%, those are the days we said were bushfire days. And we also excluded high air pollution days due to dust storms.
Okay, all right.
And so
many other things to contend with there in terms of variables.
Yes.
Yeah. My guest is Professor Ben Jalaluddin, who is a chief investigator in the Centre for Air Pollution, Energy and Health Research. And we're asking you as well, the long-term effect of air pollution, mostly from the contaminants within bushfire smoke that perhaps your community experienced last fire season, might have had some long-term impacts on your health. Have you noticed that? Have you talked about it with your local GP or even a specialist? And what can you share with us? You can leave your comments on our Facebook page. Just search for RN Life Matters. Dr. Liz Hanna is from the ANU. She's also Chair of Environmental Health for the World Federation of Public Health Associations. Hanna, hello. Sorry, Liz. Hello. Beg your pardon.
Good morning. Hi.
Liz, do these findings from this estimate of data just from pretty much four physical data collection points on health surprise you in any way?
No, not at all, which is sad, because we've known that with the acceleration of climate change that health impacts have been increasing globally, and of course Australia's pretty much at the forefront because we're hotter than many other countries. We're about 13 degrees hotter than the global average. So these things are definitely on our radar. Where it's difficult, of course, is having the research to be able to quantify it.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, that research, I guess by default, has to happen after the fact, because you have to have these events to monitor the extreme differences to events that have gone before. So now we have this data from this extraordinary fire season. How should we act upon it?
take it as a very, very salient wake-up call that we really do need to take this seriously and invest in all our systems in response. So that would include, because I speak from a public health perspective, in preparing people. And that's preparing everybody in the community, as well as preparing the systems and the health sector and the public health workforce, so that people have, and with public health, a lot of that is health promotion and health education, so that people know exactly what their risks might be in their patch of the world and what they can and need to do to optimise their chances of surviving this without any health problems. And that depends on the individual, but also where they are and the nature of the health problem.
Indeed, so.
So that needs a lot of investment to get those messages out. That's very well targeted.
Well, let's take, in fact, a case study here. Let's drill down a little further. For example, if we talk about the cost of the impact of bushfire smoke on pregnant women in some of those communities, and also on the long-term health impacts for their babies when they're born, do we have any evidence in that regard, to your knowledge?
We know from international research that there is that smoke can actually impact on the fetus, but we don't actually have that data collected. So this is where sometimes the modelling comes in to work out what the exposure was for people at the time, what proportion of people were probably pregnant at the time, and then to do estimates of what the damage is. And the other thing would be, of course, if we wanted to count, then you would have to have GPs who were alert and ask the questions, and the women to identify that, you know, yes, I was pregnant and I was exposed to smoke, and here's my child, and it's respiratory problems, or indeed other problems, because it's not only respiratory problems if you're being affected by smoke in utero, of course.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Liz, even if we don't have the hard data going back years, one can only imagine that if you're pregnant, you want to stay out of that kind of smoke.
Yes. And anecdotally, I've spoken to women who've had the wherewithal to, fly their children and fly themselves down to Tassie during that period to get away from the smoke. And, of course, not everyone has the wherewithal to be able to do that.
And bear in mind, too, that from memory, last summer, Tasmania also had some rampant bushfire outbreaks.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is where this fire was so extreme. It was, from Queensland right the way down through to Kangaroo Island. And, of course, there are many areas of Western Australia that were also alight. But it was such an extreme season. And the fireys could predict this because the fire index was so extreme that that's why they were trying to plead with the government if we could get more, those big Elvis air tankers to fight the monster fire that they knew was going to come.
Liz, I want to come back to you in a moment. I just want to check in with Ben Jalaluddin. Ben, when it comes to the actual nature of the contaminants and the particulates in smoke, I think so many of us are ignorant of just what that chemical makeup can be. Can you just take us through some of the worst threats in that kind of smoke that we might be exposed to?
Right. It's a fairly complex mixture. Smoke, you obviously have got various particles and various sizes of particles, and we're normally very interested in those very, very small particles because they're the ones that get into your lungs and they can get into your bloodstream. So we particularly, we think that they're the harmful particles. There are also various gases, as carbon monoxide and organic gases, and much of these, the constituents of the smoke, they also change over time.
Yes.
And they also depend on what is being burnt.
Of course.
So there are a number of factors that go into the makeup of the smoke. But what we can measure easily are the fine particles.
And, of course, one of the other long-term health impacts of smoke exposure I've been reading about is a very strong relationship between smoke inhalation and rises in blood glucose. And that can be a real threat for those people who are dealing with type 2 diabetes or type 1.
There is there's more and more evidence that smoke or air pollution or even urban air pollution due to traffic, cars and buses, air pollution from all the traffic-related air pollution can have impact on just more than the lungs. It has impact on the cardiovascular system or on the heart. It can have an impact on diabetes, on neurodevelopment, and also, as you mentioned earlier on women who are pregnant.
Yes.
And this increased risk of gestational diabetes. So women having diabetes whilst they're pregnant.
All these issues, Liz Hannah, seem almost overwhelming just to discuss even at this point. You've made the point too that in terms of health resourcing, staffing and preparedness, we're just not there at the moment. Does this mean massive influxes of new funding needed to get us all up to speed on this, or can we be strategic in how we do this in the future?
Education campaigns. I mean, that could be federally funded. You know, if people remember the slip, slop, slap campaign, that's a very effective way of rolling out information quickly to the entire nation. But remember, if we recognise the problems that Victoria had with those tower blocks, we've got many languages now, so we need to make sure that these messages get to people in all their appropriate languages. And so, yes, we do need rollout, and you know, I'd suggest that we actually need things at the community level, so that there would be drop-in centres, so that people can actually relate to, you know, their health issues.
Right.
And so that would cover things like even COVID, and that's a very effective way of linking the health knowledge in with the community.
While we're talking about that, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was thinking, Liz, that when it comes to the kind of restrictions to our life that we've had under COVID for the last 6 months and more in some cases, I'm wondering if that has actually helped when it comes to our absorption of preparedness for other threats to our livelihoods and, in fact, our lives. For example, it wasn't until really COVID that there was widespread Australian uptake of any kind of masks to guard against atmospheric pollution. And now that they're kind of almost standard across the board, I know that masks to screen against smoke have to have different properties perhaps to ones that guard against viruses. But do you think at least our behaviour patterns are heading in the right direction?
Yeah, so you get the additional learnings, I guess, once people have crossed that barrier in the fact that I'm okay, Australia's clean and green, we don't need to do anything, to recognising the fact that there are threats out there, and so people are more receptive to picking up these messages relating to other things and responding appropriately once that, you know, that barrier's got over, and the fact that, well, I can wear a mask if I need to. If we know they're very they're ubiquitous in those countries around the world that have very severe air pollution continually. Fortunately, Australia's not that bad all the time. But as Ben was saying, the environmental pollutants and toxics, when they trigger an immune response, there's a vast array of health problems that can manifest afterwards.
Yes.
And so we need to be, you know, Australia's quite sort of lackadaisical in thinking that we don't really have a problem, whereas there are issues out there and we do need to be alert.
We kind of stereotype ourselves as being part of the great outdoors, because our great outdoors is, you know, rugged and tough and clean and green. And clearly that isn't always the case, and it's time to rethink that. Does that mean that when it comes to, I guess, prevention being better than cure, that we have to face the hard fact that during summer bushfire seasons where smoke contamination is imminent, we just have to spend more time indoors?
Because we know that there will be more fires, and I think more people are getting the message that not only is it unpleasant, you know, because we were in Canberra, we couldn't really go outside for 6 weeks here during the fires, and you know, with the stinging of the eyes and the making you feel quite nauseated, that was a great incentive. People just stayed indoors. The
yeah.
big problem was, of course, that if you were inland, you have evaporative air conditioning, which sucks air out. Outside air into your house, you couldn't have that in. So when you've got the double whammy of the heat plus the smoke, you couldn't use your cooling systems, and so your house was hot. So this is where there are multiple layers of problems that are coming through, and this is the, you know, the complexity that we need to sort this out in our messaging and in our responses.
Well, I know we've only started this conversation, but I think $2 billion worth of costs, which has been, as already explained, is only the tip of a much larger iceberg when you look at mental health and other ripple effects through the community. Hopefully, we can find ways of convincing our policymakers that this is money well spent if we can guard against this. In the meantime, it's been great to talk to both of you. Thanks very much indeed for taking the time here on Life Matters.
Absolute pleasure, and stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Ben Jalaluddin, who's an environmental epidemiologist, and Dr. Liz Hannah, who's the Chair of Environmental Health for the World Federation of Public Health Associations.